This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachel. It's been more than 3 years since Colin Kaepernick, wearing an NFL uniform, publicly protested police brutality and racial inequality. During the 2016 football season, the former 49ers quarterback refused to stand during the pregame national anthem, choosing to drop to one knee. He has not been signed to an NFL team since that season ended. His actions and the refusal of the NFL teams to sign him have set off heated debates. And the latest chapter in the story came earlier this month when Kaepernick was invited to work out for NFL teams in Atlanta. After tension over the logistics and the parameters of the event, Kaepernick made a last-minute location change and set off another round of controversy. Does Colin Kaepernick have a future in the NFL? And what questions does this ongoing tension raise about the power and peril of being a black athlete? One of the many topics we'll talk about today on Back Channel, a recurring series connecting culture and context. We will also review a new movie, Harriet, and a documentary about the legendary history of New York City's Apollo Theater, and a book that traces a series of letters from a mother to her two black sons. Joining me for all of that and more are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie Bullock Brown is a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State University. Natalie, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Good to be here, Frank. Thank you.
And Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke, and author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Hello to you, Mark.
How you doing, Frank?
I'm doing okay. Let's talk a little bit more about this workout debacle. tell us, outline the story for us. What's happened here?
Colin Kaepernick, of course, you know, once he let his contract finish a few years ago, has not been signed by an NFL team in 3 years. I don't think anyone disputes the fact that based on his talent and his skill set, he should have a job in the NFL. The reasons why he doesn't are complicated, but it largely has to do with, you know, the ownership of NFL teams being fearful of the backlash. Particularly once President Trump got involved in this, you know, back in 17, they're afraid of the kind of backlash that might exist if they were to go out on a limb and sign Colin Kaepernick. As the story goes, you know, some combination of the NFL commissioner and perhaps Jay-Z and a few other folks conspired to create a workout situation where individual teams didn't have to feel isolated in the interests of Colin Kaepernick. But there was a rider in the agreement in which he would have done the workout, which basically said that, you know, if he didn't get a job, he would not be able to sue them afterwards if he thought the process was unfair. And it's in the context of that that Colin Kaepernick pulled out of the workout and set up his own workout. That gets complex also because when you look at his workout, the school that it was held, you know, William C. Roden talks about the fact he chose a black high school named after Charles Drew. The fact that there was already security there was a crowd there. You know, he didn't just momentarily decide to switch to another location. This likely was something that was planned all along.
All right. So, and there it is. And once again, not set up. The Jay-Z connection, Jay-Z and the NFL have a business relationship now. We think that it was Jay-Z and Goodell, the commissioner of the NFL, who perhaps worked this deal out, and maybe they didn't even tell other NFL teams, just some way to make it look like we're giving them a chance. Natalie, what's your take on what's going on?
I have a couple of thoughts. I mean, I guess the main thing is that I feel very strongly about is that the NFL was not sincere in their offer, you know, to set up this workout for Colin Kaepernick. I think it was this is a one point that I agree with Stephen A. Smith in his commentary about the whole thing. It was cover. The NFL was trying to provide like a, you know, an excuse, basically. Or a way to say, look, we gave him a chance. He didn't take it, or he was horrible, and so we're not going to hire him. But I don't think that they were ever really intending to hire him. So the extent to which Jay-Z might have been involved stinks, because it just, maybe he was well-intentioned, and I think he probably was, but it was not well thought out, at least from his perspective. What Colin basically bucked against was what I think the NFL required of him, which was to stay in his place, to show some sort of contrition for the furor that he is to blame for over, you know, the backlash that came from him kneeling and all the stuff that happened in the aftermath of that. And Colin Kaepernick is not that black man. He was not going to say to the NFL, I will do anything, Massa, to in order to get back in your good graces and play football. And I think the fact that there are actually black folks who think that he should have capitulated to what Mark just laid out, especially a waiver that says you can't sue us if you think that we, you know, operated in bad faith, it reeks the high heaven of insincerity, hypocrisy, and all kinds of other things.
The planning of it was really weird. You know, the workout was going to be on a Saturday, which is traditionally a travel day for owners and GMs. So, you know, who was actually going to be there on a Saturday as opposed to a Tuesday, right, which is typically an off day, right, you know, for everybody in the league. I think it also has a big deal to do with, you know, Kaepernick, obviously, but the position. You know, someone has made the point, and I think rightfully so, you know, there are players who kneel that are still in the league. Right. Kenny Stills with the Miami Dolphins, Eric Reed right here in Carolina. Eric Reed has been as outspoken, if not more outspoken, both about police brutality, his treatment within the league in terms of his blood testing, and also Colin Kaepernick. But, you know, folks don't know who Eric Reed is, right? Folks don't know who Kenny Stills is. As a quarterback, you are the face of a franchise, right? And the owners are really responding to that. You know, when they're concerned about their brand, the quarterback is the brand, and no one is willing to take that risk for Colin Kaepernick to be the face of the brand.
Well, I think that's it. Brand is it. You referenced Stephen A. Smith, a sports journalist on ESPN frequently, who talked about this. He has taken up for Colin Kaepernick over and over again, but didn't like this particular event. Let's listen to what he had to say about this particular, because I think the idea of brand and the fact that both Kaepernick and the NFL had created a scenario here, a publicity event, right, may be what's at play. Let's listen to Stephen A. Smith.
A half hour before your workout was scheduled was when they were informed that you would not show up. Then not only do you do that, when you show up, there are a whole bunch of people there wearing I'm with Kaepernick jerseys or T-shirts that said, I know my rights, okay? So clearly it was orchestrated. Security was there, videographers and all of this stuff was there. You knew all along that you were going to have this event there, but you didn't tell the NFL until 2:30. You snubbed your nose at the NFL. You snubbed your nose at Roc Nation. You snubbed your nose at the bunch of officials who showed up. Then you show up and you give your speech and spiel to the media that you wanted present, but you didn't take any questions and all of this stuff. You just look at it and it reeks of a PR stunt, a PR campaign, the kind of thing that you accused the NFL of doing. And as far as I'm concerned, again, I want him in the league. I think what's happened to him is unfair. But the manner in which he has handled this, if an NFL team never called him again, what can we say?
Stephen A. Smith on ESPN. And, of course, the other side of the publicity stunt is the fact, as a number of commentators have pointed out, Colin Kaepernick is a free agent. What would you do with free agents? Anytime you want, you can call them in and say, work out with me. So nobody in the history of the NFL has organized a workout for one guy, apart from what they call the combine, which is a whole separate event for people you don't know. So obviously this thing was created for the press. It's an event that doesn't happen. It's an extraordinary event. And then the way it was handled, it really does muddy things up. What do you think we go from here in this story?
I think you have two groups of people who, at least in the case of Colin Kaepernick, rightfully doesn't trust the NFL. I've often wondered over these 3 years to what extent Colin Kaepernick needs the NFL or needs a job, right? Mm-hmm. He's about to launch via Nike one of the best-selling named sneakers in the history of Nike, you know, not called Jordan, mm-hmm. let alone whatever his payout was with the NFL. He's actually a much visible figure as an activist, right? You know, does he make the choice that that's his path going forward? My colleague Shauna Redman, you know, she makes that point in comparing him to someone like Paul Robeson. At some point, Paul Robeson was bigger than his vocation, right? And it didn't matter that he couldn't sing in Pete's skill. It didn't matter this, this, or that. What he represented was bigger than that. And I think that's where we're at with Colin Kaepernick at this point.
Right. I just think that, you know, he's standing up for something that's much bigger than a job with the NFL. And I think that if it was just about him wanting a job, if that was really where his focus is, I think that possibly he would have played things differently. But I don't think, I've seen quite a few people say this, and I think it's true. Colin Kaepernick is a free black man. He does not play respectability politics. So he's not making decisions based on, oh, I want this job so bad, I'm going to compromise, like, my good sense. It's clearly, this is not meant to be a good situation for me. He saw that. And I think the fact that he controlled the narrative in a way that, you know, pissed off the NFL is a part of what Stephen A. Smith's problem is with it. Like, you don't piss off your employer. Yeah, but if you're standing for something like police brutality, like the treatment of black people in general, social justice as an issue and as something, you know, as something that you're going to hold forth, then you don't capitulate. You don't back down just because you want a job. And I think he shows incredible courage to sacrifice what he so clearly deserves and wants for us.
Well, this also leads us to the question about the NCAA and its decision to allow, under some circumstances, students to capitalize on their name. We'll talk about that when we return with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on this edition of Back Channel. This on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. One shining moment you were willing to try. One shining moment you knew. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, still here with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel. We turn now to the NCAA. Last month, the organization's Board of Governors voted unanimously to permit college athletes to benefit from their name, image, and likeness. This after California, the state of California, passed the Fair Pay to Play Act, which would prohibit schools from punishing athletes for exercising their commercial rights. So right here, let's listen to a statement from Val Ackerman. She is the commissioner of the Big East Conference.
We do think it's possible to do this in a way that maintains the collegiate model, stops short of pay for play, and addresses the concerns that many lawmakers in particular have articulated over the last few months.
Val Ackerman, commissioner of the Big East Conference, speaking on ABC about the NCAA's new name, image, and likeness policy. I'm here with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. A lot of people predicted this. They said once California passes that law, the NCAA is going to have to change its tune. But Mark, what do you think?
I think it's a step in the right direction. I mean, it's something well below the standard of paying for play or allowing athletes to be salaried. It is an attempt to recognize that there are particularly high-profile athletes who in many ways their images and their brand is being exploited by the NCAA and the individual teams. It allows them to get an opportunity to make some money, you know, off of it. You know, the Fab Five, Chris Webber and Jalen Rose and those folks, you know, they talked about the irony that when they were freshmen at Michigan back in the early 90s, you know, they're on a per diem and they're eating hot dogs and boxed macaroni and cheese and they're seeing their jerseys being sold, you know, in an athletic store. So, I mean, this is an opportunity to rectify this particular situation, but it's really only going to impact the most visible of these athletes.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I would you speak more about that? Why do you say that it will only impact the most visible?
I mean, because if you're a golfer.
Right. Okay. Gotcha. Right.
You know, or I mean, we're really talking about the high profile sports and the most high profile players in those sports.
Right.
So the skill positions, right? We know what the quarterback looks like. We know what the running back looks like. We generally have no idea who the offensive linemen look like.
Right. So, I mean, it's interesting to me that this issue, I mean, we know that 60% of NCAA athletes, at least, are black, right? And there seems to be a lot of support for this type of monetization of jerseys and so forth, likeness and so forth. I definitely agree that it is a step in the right direction. I think, you know, more steps could be taken, but I wonder how it's actually going to play out.
Well, a lot of people wonder that. I mean, the devil seems to be in the details. And, of course, the idea that the NCAA would capitulate so quickly shocked a lot of people until they read the fine print. And the fine print is, you can do it, but we get to write the rules. And that has people like the aforementioned Jalen Rose very concerned.
basically when he says he doesn't basically want to see athletes, student athletes compete against professionals, he deems professionals those that are capitalizing off their name and their likeness and their imagery. So that's a contradiction in itself. It's just laughable when I see people on both sides really are patting themselves on the back like change has happened when it really hasn't taken place.
All right, that's former basketball player and current ESPN sports analyst Jalen Rose talking about that new name and likeness rule. And, of course, the reference is that we don't want to put you on a par with athletes who are already in the pros. Well, of course, that means that those kinds of limitations may well mean that you can't make the money you deserve.
Right. So how level is the playing field going to actually be?
Also, the marketplace may, in this case, straighten things out because, again, if agents are going to say, oh, yeah, if you go with the NCAA rules, you're never going to make a nickel. But California doesn't allow that. So kids, come on over here to California. You can bet the Arizona legislature or other state legislatures will take more robust action. I would think if they start actually losing athletes.
I think there's no question about that. You know, the individual states will react in that way. I think the other part of it is that the NCAA is really protecting its brand. You know, what the trend that we've started to see, for instance, in baseball, where players have been foregoing the Major League Baseball process and signing direct professional contracts in Japan. You know, what they're warding against is the next generation of Zion Williamson, you know, that says, I don't need any of this at all. Mm-hmm. Right. And I can, you know, try to figure out a way to go more directly to Selma, where to take advantage of my image. Again, Zion had 1 million Instagram followers even before he set foot on Duke's campus. So there was already a brand there. If anything, right, Duke benefited from his visibility that year, you know, besides the stuff that he did on court.
All right. So to a certain extent, it depends on, there are all kinds of tiers to this because if we're talking about the most visible athletes and the most visible sports, then we also are talking about, I mean, just to Mark's example of Zion Williamson, if he had 1 million followers, right, then he's already savvy about how much he's worth in a way that not all athletes are going to be. And so who is going to step in and actually mentor them in a way that's going to result in proceeds that will be meaningful?
All right, let's move on. I want to talk about a new book now. What does a black mother want most for her two black sons? Well, for scholar and writer Imani Perry, it is a society that sees them in their full humanity. Her new book is a collection of letters in which she blends stories and insights from her own life and those of the words of writers and thinkers that she admires. And here's a clip of writer and scholar Imani Perry, who's reading from her book, Breathe, A Letter to My Sons.
I have taught you not to love white people. That sentence may get me in trouble. Of course you love individual white people. I do too, many in fact. But I have taught you not to love them as a group because whiteness as such means hating oneself. And I have taught you to love black people. Of course there are individual black people that you dislike or even despise. I do too. There are black people I dislike so much I don't want to lay eyes on them. But loving black people is not about each individual. It is about something bigger than that.
Scholar and writer Imani Perry reading from her book, Breathe, A Letter to My Sons, at the Free Library in Philadelphia. I'm talking about it with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel. Natalie went right to the most controversial excerpt from that book. But we'll talk about that in a second, but maybe we'll take one step back and set it up for us, too. The book itself, which is actually, you know, sort of in a long line of books that talk to the next generation.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think about Breathe maybe in the same way that I think about Ta-Nehisi Coates' book. And, you know, there is something really poignant about a black parent writing directly to their black child or children in this particular moment, but also in general, because there is so much that you want to impart as a parent to your children about whiteness, about blackness, about loving yourself, about not hating yourself, and all the messaging and communications, you know, that come from mass media and just society in general that would say you don't matter. Your life doesn't matter. You're not beautiful. You're not worth anything. And so I just really appreciate, as a mother of two black children, Imani's not only her just determination if she was going to write this, but her voice, which to me just echoes, you know, all of our best writers, although it is uniquely her voice that we hear when you read the book. So it's kind of unfortunate that, you know, she has to do it. Right. Yeah. That it has to be sort of a that it's a memoir in ways that is really not even appealing to white folks to see her sons in, you know, in all of their humanity, but that she's trying to get them to really own and embrace and lean into their own humanity.
Mark?
One of the reasons why I think the book is really important, because I think we fetishize the idea of the engaged black father. Part of what everybody loved about Ta-Nehisi's book was that it was this idea that a black man was so engaged in the parenting process that he would write a letter to his son. We don't nearly see as many examples of black women mothering in that way, though we know that they carry a lot of weight in the context of parenting. So the book is very important with that in that regard. Many folks who have followed Imani's career for a long time have had the benefit of watching literally these boys grow up, you know, on social media and other places. So now for her to be able to find a way to actually give them voice through her voice, you know, is important.
Yeah.
And then just a quick thing about Imani, you know, in the last 18 months, she's published 4 books.
Right.
You know,
she's
an award-winning book on Lift Every Voice and Sing, an award-winning book on the playwright
Lorraine Hansberry,
a book for Duke Press on black feminism, and now this book, you know, this letter to her sons, which when all is said and done, it's probably the book that's actually going to have the most impact, you know, on readers.
Yep. What about that? She got a lot of pushback from that clip that we played, her reading from the book, the idea that, you know, I don't want you to love white people. Of course, there are individual white people, she goes on. The fact that because she's very clear about what she means,
even
in the excerpt. Mm-hmm. I mean, she goes on to explain it later when anybody asks her, but it's very clear that she's not saying hate all white people.
Right.
She's talking about, she says, the concept of whiteness. Are you surprised at the pushback she's gotten from that?
Not at all. I mean, I think that there is a way that whiteness exists as a collective that is very fragile. And so any sort of critique, anything that just hints at, you know, a way that black folks in particular are not like lifting it up as the paragon of, you know, what you should aspire to, is going to be challenged, is going to be questioned, is going to be suspected. And, you know, there, it is never read as it is intended. Mm. And as you said, Imani is completely clear about what she means. So I think it's just white fragility that folk are getting up in their feelings about her even saying it in the first place.
Let's talk about some of the stories in the book. Mark, you talked about the fact that she, you know, we've grown up with her, under, you know, knowing these boys through social media and otherwise. And she told some very, I think, poignant stories, particularly one where they were having trouble with the alarm in the house. And it was a troubling story, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, right, because you don't want the police to show up and mistake the fact that this is your house, right?
Yeah.
I mean, all we have to do is think about what happened to that young woman in Texas just a month ago.
Right.
And, you know, even as she's trying to defuse the situation, always worried that someone will just see this random black kid in their mind and think that it's a threat in a situation that it's
she
not.
She actually had to tell the boys to stay in their room because they weren't able to get the police on time when the alarm went off accidentally. The police are now at the door, and she tells them, stay in your room because, you know, I don't know what will happen if you poke your head out.
And those are the stories that black parents tell that not only don't white parents know, they can't even process, right, why that would be something that would have to happen in their context.
Right. And also, I don't think white parents understand why a black mother or a black parent, for that matter, would talk about whiteness in the way that Imani does. Mm-hmm. There is no reckoning with what it means to be white in this society. And, you know, I think part of what is really poignant to me is that not only is Imani talking about the humanity of her sons, but she's also sort of by extension talking about her own humanity. And the reality is that in that instance, what you just described with the police, she had no guarantee that she was going to come out of that thing alive,
right?
And she knew that her sons because they are young black men, they were right. in danger. But let's not forget that she was too. And so there is a way that this, you know, that talking about just being black and surviving in this culture as a black person is an important conversation to have, but it's not just for our children. It is for all of us to understand our own humanity and to lean into that.
Well, let's take a look at an artistic meditation on being a black boy in America today. The Netflix film American Son, based on a Broadway play of the same name. The premise is that on the night a teenage boy goes missing, his parents end up in the police precinct. They're trying to figure out what happened to him. They're an interracial couple whose marriage is on the rocks. And so here's a clip from a scene when they are talking to each other about what went on and about the mother's fears that the worst has happened.
You think Kendra, our bougie son has no right to associate with other black kids without stamping a presumption of guilt all over himself?
No, I think our half white, half black, who gives a shit what race he is, son, the one who got 1470 on his SATs and aced AP physics, knows better than to commit unforced errors in life by taking stupid risks. Especially when he is on the cusp of doing great things. I think he understands that, like it or not, the way that you present yourself in life has consequences. If you wear your pants halfway down your ass and ghetto hair, then
you got no right to complain when you walk by and a white lady clutches her purse. No matter how many privileges he's got, the world still looks at him like it looks at me, not you.
Oh, boy.
Clip from American Son, a new movie on Netflix. Natalie, what'd you think?
Ooh, well, I'm in many ways, I'm still processing it. But I think in general, it's really powerful for several reasons. One, I think there's something really interesting about a play being turned into a movie. Yeah. And the fact that there is this economy of setting, like everything mm-hmm. takes place in this one room, which challenges, I think, the average American viewer, because we're my son was watching it with me and he was like, are they going to do something? You know, well, like, when are they going to move? Yeah. When's some action going to yeah. take place? You know, so that's a part of what you have to, like, grapple with. But I think in the midst of that, it's appropriate because the issues and the themes that are being presented are also, you know, challenging to grapple with, because it's not everything is not as it seems. And so as things are revealed about the son, about who his father is, his own ideas about his own son, and you know, Kerry Washington's character's ideas about her son and her understanding of what it means to be a black boy in society. I mean, it's very complex. And I think it's done pretty well, the way that everything is woven together.
What do you think, Mark? Because that has been a criticism in terms of how it was done. Not yeah. that the issues aren't complex and very important, but that the writing and acting may have not served it as well. Mm. That's been some of the critique.
So I was fortunate to see it on Broadway, did a talk back with the cast. I was happy given the fact that the play had such a short run, right? What happens when you actually have working actors, mm-hmm. right, who got other things to do.
Mm-hmm.
That a wider audience would see it. I was also concerned about whether or not that would translate, you know, to the flat screen, right? It's the difference between Tyler Perry plays and Tyler Perry movies, however you feel about Tyler Perry.
Right.
That being said, I thought they were able to do small things like flashbacks, like when you see her on the screen arguing with her son, who you never see. I mean, those kind of technological things they could bring to play to give some sort of grounding. Again, that being said, I think we've gotten so accustomed to the Marvel movie mm-hmm. where everything has to blow up.
Right? Right.
I remember as a kid seeing a movie like My Dinner with Andre mm-hmm. and being challenged by that, mm-hmm. you know. And so the fact that we have to grapple with this in the immediacy and the interpersonal space that they have, I think the film, the teleplay, if you will, does amazing work to highlight these issues. I mean, even as you're trying to figure out what's going on with Jamal, just watching the dynamics between Kerry Washington's character and her ex-husband's character
yeah.
work through what their relationship yeah. was and where it started and how it unraveled and how their son now is yeah. the chess piece
yes. yeah.
for them yeah. working through the process yeah. of it. The young police officer, right, who just shows no kind of connection to anybody in this, right? He's just doing a job and following a script. And then to have to deal with the older black policeman, right, who brings a kind of sense of gravitas but doesn't play to the party line of what it means to be a brother
yeah.
in this context. I mean, it's extraordinary that it was able to be done in a way that so many more folks have access to it.
Back channel on the State of Things Today, Natalie Bullock Brown, a filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State, Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke. We're going to talk about the new documentary that looks at the history of the Apollo Theater when we return to the State of Things. Stay tuned.
For you, you, yours is the quest has just begun. When you're feeling real low, here's a great truth you should remember and know that you're gifted and blessed.
This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Back channel today, our recurring series connecting culture and context with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Let us turn now to a new HBO documentary about New York City's historic Apollo Theater. Let's listen to a clip from the film.
These artists who weren't necessarily literate musicians, who maybe got a record deal and a hit song and need to take it on the road, how do you acquire those skills? You hang out backstage.
Oh, sometimes I get a good feeling, yeah. Yeah. I get a feeling that I never, 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 never had before. No, no.
The Apollo, it was more like a university.
I just wanna tell you.
It was like going to school when Gladys and I played the Apollo Theater. I learned how to be gracious to the audience.
Something's got a hold on me, yeah.
That's a clip featuring Gladys Knight and Patti LaBelle from the new HBO documentary Apollo, The Apollo. It traces the history of that historic Apollo Theater in New York City. I'm here with Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark, tell us more about the history of the Apollo.
Amazing theater. First, shout out to Guthrie Ramsey. It was great to see him in the documentary and just hear his voice. You know, it was a theater in Harlem when Harlem was still Jewish. And at some point, there's a turnover in the community, and they're trying to figure out how to fill the seats, and they begin to fill the seats, Mr. Schiffman, with African-American acts. And it becomes this cornerstone of what we call the, you know, the Chitlin Circuit, with the early generation of folks called, you know, the circuit where it was tough on black asses. you know, where folks are working 5-6 shows a day sometimes, you know, to make a living. But it's also literally a cradle for African-American culture throughout the 20th century. Everyone who was somebody at some point had to come through the Apollo and play for their crowd or play for amateur night, right, and get booed off stage. That clip of a young Lauryn Hill, you
yes,
know, being
wow.
booed off yeah. stage. It's fascinating. Yeah. You know, we've heard the number of times that Luther Vandross was booed off the Apollo stage. So it is literally a cultural resource for not just Black America, but America.
I mean, what I found striking was that the Apollo was clearly a rite of passage, mm-hmm. you know, and yeah. it, the way that it was as Patti LaBelle said, a university. It was a place where artists learned from each other, but also, you know, about how to present and stand and deliver to an audience was really fascinating.
And Mark, the documentary, it seems to me, raises the next question, I think the one that you're getting at too, Natalie, which is, you know, where from here? Is this going to be a museum, or are we talking yeah. about something? And it talks about Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me, as a stage production at the Apollo, looking forward.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are a couple of things I think there. I mean, what you find out about the Apollo is that what happens when the brand of blackness outperforms the expectations of some place like the Apollo. You know, at some point, you know, Aretha Franklin is playing the Apollo because she can't play Madison Square Garden. Gladys Knight and the Pips are playing the Apollo Theater because they can't play Radio City Music Hall. And that's not even just about the race politics. That's just like there's a fear that they can't fill up the seats in that way. And then when Mr. Schiffman talks about, his son talks about this moment where they can't compete with these larger venues that now want all of these black acts, they have to figure out what to do, right? And it was Percy Sutton when he took over is like, you know, we can't sustain this anymore. How do we create something else that finds so much more value? The question is whether, how do you monetize that in a way that makes it sustainable? I thought one of the most poignant things is that when black icons die, everybody comes to the Apollo just to stand there, right? James Brown's funeral is at the Apollo. Right, everyone's standing out when Aretha Franklin dies, and they're all performing her songs outside. It still has that kind of cultural value, and I think it was wise of the leadership now to think about new ways to curate the history of the Apollo going forward. So the idea of a stage reading of Ta-Nehisi Coates' book makes absolute sense in that context.
Yeah. Let's turn now to a new film from a 19-year-old filmmaker. It's called Burning Cain, a portrait of life in a Southern Black Baptist community in Louisiana. Here's a clip from the trailer.
He who dies with the most toys wins. You can go out there and try to get a pretty dress, but it don't mean nothing if you're going to lose your soul.
These young people don't believe a goddamn word I'm preaching up there on that stage, and I know it.
No toys get you into heaven. It's the friendships that you have. It's the kindness that you do. Did you clothe me when I was naked? Did you give me housing when I had no place to live? Did you feed me when I was hungry? Did you drink, give me water to drink when I was thirsty?
You don't think I can hold my liquor?
Back up now. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world but lose his soul? Amen? Amen.
Amen. Here it goes. Thank a clip you. From the trailer of Burning Cain, a new film by 19-year-old director Philip Eumanns, acquired by Ava DuVernay's company Array, now streaming on Netflix. Natalie, give us more of the premise of this film.
Well, it's basically a sort of treatise, I would say, on the Southern Black Baptist Church and toxic masculinity. And it's sort of anchored by these three characters. A woman whose son is an alcoholic and has a very interesting way of sort of nurturing and taking care of his young son. And then her pastor, whose voice we heard and is played brilliantly by the actor Wendell Pierce. And he's also an alcoholic, even though he's a pastor. So it's a very interesting and I think very subtle and brilliant just exploration of these different themes and the ways that the church is often a refuge from the realities of black life. And I just really appreciate the fact that this young filmmaker, Philip Eumanns, he did this film when he was 17. I mean, he shot it.
On summer break.
Yes, during summer break before his senior year in high school. And it's so sophisticated, I think, the way that he deals with these issues that we are going to be hearing about him for a long time, I think.
Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, there's a scene later in the movie, not to talk too much about the plot, but there's some violence that occurs off screen. And when this older woman goes to confide in her minister about what had happened, and he just goes, you keep that between you and God. I mean, that very toxic masculinity that you're talking about, right? And we get a sense of this even existing, obviously, with the character, the woman character's dead husband, who we do know died of HIV, and her son has a very different narrative of why his life went the way it went, right, in that context. What I loved about the film is that it just tells the story. I don't think I can sit through too many more 2.5 hour long movies. Tell the story in the 70 or 80 minutes that you got and tell a compelling story, and people will want to see more work from you.
Yeah, I just want to say that that is one of the things I think is brilliant about this filmmaker. The economy of the visuals. There's not a lot of exposition through dialogue. There's not a lot of exposition through voiceover. The images and the way he frames these characters, just the shots, it's so clear that he has a gift for just the cinematic language.
Look, if I have to, I can never look at the cooking of a chicken.
Right.
The same
right.
For the 4 minutes that that woman spent cleaning and cooking that chicken,
yes.
The film is worth it for just those visuals.
But it also does something very difficult, which it takes on this very important cultural institution, the church. It is critical of the church when it is protecting some of the toxic elements that need to, as Natalie, you point out, be talked about and maybe exorcised. Mm-hmm. But does it in kind of a loving way. It's not just a screed. And talking about this, you know, young film producer who obviously, you know, has strong feelings about the church, but also was raised in it.
Yes.
And so he's not. There's a certain power in that too,
absolutely,
trying to restrain the way the way in which you voice that critique.
Yeah.
I want to talk about another film now, Harriet, starring Cynthia Erivo, which tells the story of abolitionist Harriet Tubman. Let's listen to a clip from the film.
Rescuing slaves requires skill and careful planning. It requires reading, Harriet. Can you read a sign or a map? Can you read it all?
I put my attention on trying to hear God's voice more clearly.
Do you know what would happen if you got caught? They would torture you until you pointed them right to this office. You got lucky, Harriet. And there's nothing more you can do.
Don't you tell me what I can't do. I made it this far on my own. God was watching, but my feet was my own. Running, bleeding, climbing, nearly drowned. Nothing to eat for days and days, man. I made it. So don't you tell me what I can't do.
A clip from the film Harriet, now in theaters, tracing the story of abolitionist Harriet Tubman, talking about it with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, what'd you think?
Yeah, I think that Harriet is powerful. I think it is important because this is the first treatment of Harriet Tubman in a way that humanizes her, that helps us to understand something about who she was and how powerful a person, just a human being she was. You know, that scene that we just heard really underscores something that is, to me, in contrast to Burning Cain. And that is this idea that, you know, Harriet says, it was my own feet that did the running, right? I was hearing from God, but I did the work. And that is different from what Burning Cain talks about, which is, you know, just give it to God and he'll take care of it. And I really appreciate the sort of progressive notion of not only what it means to be a faith person, right? Someone who believes in God and feels like you hear from him and follows that, but a Black woman who is able to forge her own path. And this is in the late 19th century. This is at a time when there were no rights for Black women. I mean, she ran away from slavery. So this is remarkable to find out about and have this type of character, this type of legendary African-American ancestor lifted up in a way that complicates her in ways that are so different from what we hear about at Black History Month.
Right, the Black History Month timeline where you're just flat against the blackboard, right?
Yeah, so it's important in all of those respects, I think.
It says a great deal about a filmmaker who can create an element of suspense for a story that you already know how it ends.
Yes, right.
And Cassie Lemons does that throughout the film, right?
Yep.
You're
the director.
On the edge of your seat, the director. Yeah. The performances of Clark Peters, Vanessa Bell Calloway, Vonda Curtis Hall, you know, who also worked with her in Eve's Bayou, Omar Dorsey. The performances were absolutely amazing. And, you know, the film came with some controversy, right? Folks who, the quote-unquote ADOS folks who were critical of having a British actress
play
the lead role.
Let me stop you there because she talked about that. The idea that a British actress can't play an African American who is, you know, related to, who comes out of slavery. And this has been a very strong criticism. It's been seen many places. And she was asked about that very controversy. Here's what she had to say.
I think there's a misconception that when you're in the UK, you sort of get to bypass all the awful things that happen to you as a Black person, but you don't. I've experienced it since I was a little girl. I walk in a room and the first thing you see is the fact that I'm a dark-skinned Black girl. That's what you see first. Mm. And when I'm in the UK, no one goes, she's a Brit. they go, she's a black girl. Mm-hmm. You know?
Right,
so
right.
That's what happens. I miss out on roles because I'm a black girl and I'm too dark. Or I don't get seen for something because she's not marketable. Or no one would see me in the music business when I was a singer because I was a black girl. That's it. Like, nothing bypasses me. So the experience I have has set me up enough to know what it feels like to be othered and discounted.
British actress Cynthia Erivo talking on Hot 97 about her role in Harriet. Mark, what do you think about this controversy, though?
You know, I think it's ridiculous on some level. You know, can you bring life to the particular role? I think that's important. And she does that stunningly, right? I would not be surprised if there aren't, a bunch of nominations for her performance here. But I also understand some of the concerns, right? This is the first treatment,
right,
of Harriet Tubman.
Which is a shame in and of itself.
Up on the big screen, yeah, right? And folks, yeah, are really, really concerned about what that representation is like. And what I will say to folks who have not seen the film, who have kind of bought into these criticisms, is that from a representation standpoint, this film does justice to who Harriet Tubman is. It also creates a way to think more broadly about who she is. Her relationship with Marie obviously was more intimate than Cassie Lemons could present on screen, mm-hmm, but that's also a part of who Harriet Tubman was, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And that part of the story needs to be told also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that there is definitely some reason to be concerned about a British actress being given a role for an African American, right, representing an African American. Because part of the controversy is that apparently Cynthia Erivo has made comments, yeah, about, really disparaging African Americans. I can't really parse out exactly what she said.
One of the things she said was, you know, I guess now that I've got this role, I'm going to have to come up with a ghetto accent.
That's right.
That
right. Thank. Right. OK, so that makes sense. OK, from what I've seen.
But is that a shot at black folks or is that a shot at filmmakers, yeah, who might expect a black, yeah, actor to have that accent?
Right. Right. But I think also there is a way that black actresses in America are often overlooked for roles that, I mean, it just seems like you would, right, naturally give them the roles that are created that require black folks to play them. I mean, case in point, in 94, when the script for Harriet was first being shopped, a white studio exec recommended Julia Roberts. To play Harriet Tubman.
She's a very good actress. Did you see her? Well, I take your point.
There's a reason, yeah, yeah, why folk are a little, yeah, disgruntled, because why can't we just get the American black girls a chance, yeah, to play some roles? But Cynthia Erivo absolutely, I think, embodies, mm-hmm, you know, in a very powerful way, the spirit of Harriet Tubman. So I think it's a little unfair to just dismiss and boycott the film without seeing it.
Natalie Bullock Brown, filmmaker and teaching assistant professor at NC State. Mark Anthony Neal, James B. Duke professor and chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.